Okay, good evening. On behalf of the library, welcome to the next in our series of book talks. I'm David Kramer, director of the library, and we're very pleased that you could make it this evening without difficulty, without cancellation on account of the weather. This is a rescheduled talk. After Barbara's finished, I will share with you some of the upcoming schedule of talks that we have. But we're here for the purpose that you know this evening, and that is to hear something about this book, Memory and Covenant. I by way of introduction, want to say a couple of things. I had the privilege of sitting on the defense committee for this book when it was still a dissertation. I remember well the experience of reading the dissertation for the first time, which was really a source of enormous excitement, because it was clear to me as I began to read that here we had a focus on something that was so crucially important and yet had not been focused on in the same way before, that this was really something new. There was a discovery here. It would change the way I and whoever else was reading this book understood components of the way different elements of the biblical text, of the Torah text, understood some of the most crucial elements of Israelite religion and ultimately of what we call Judaism. I could read my own blurb on the back, but I'm not going to do that. I think far more eloquent is Dr. Geller's blurb on the back. I'm not even going to read that, because I think that it was on the, you know, on the literature promoting this talk. What I'm going to do is just tell you a very short story, which I hope that you will confirm, meaning that my memory is serving me correctly. Barra was my student in a Talmud class, right, if I remember. Was it your first Talmud class?
No, it wasn't, but it was Avodah Zarah.
It was like very, right, it was early on.
It was wine.
Right,
wine.
And I remember it was a class that I looked forward to very, very much for one simple reason, because there is this odd culture around this institution of privileging people whose Hebrew excels, and they think that they can coast on the Hebrew without thinking to the next stage of what's going on. That was the Talmud class, Hebrew and Aramaic. Now, at that time, as hard as it is to imagine, Barra's experience with these languages was more limited. It's clear from what she's written here that she's made enormous strides since then. But it was more limited. The reason I love the class, though, is because every time she spoke up, it provided an opportunity for me to grin in recognition that the students who thought they could get away with it, with good Hebrew backgrounds, but without the full intelligence that a good analysis requires, just listening to what she had to contribute in class, Aramaic being her native language or not, nevertheless really balanced the class and provided us all with an opportunity to learn from a superb critical mind. And that same critical mind is brought to the material in this book. So we're all going to learn from what you have to say tonight.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I do hope that my Hebrew has gotten a little better. My Aramaic, I'm not so sure. And that's a very nice way of saying that I really was pretty limited at that time. I've told people before, I actually started with Aleph Bet, meaning the alphabet, when I was 38. So, and I'm considerably older than that, but that gives you a sense of when it started. Two other digressionary things before I begin. One, I have never ever before given a talk from a computer screen. So if there are a couple of like pauses, it's because the screen didn't do what I was expecting it. And I've also never given a talk sitting, so I hope that won't make me feel weird. But anyway, so.
You're welcome to stand up.
No, it's okay. This whole thing is set up now for us. Okay, anyway, so. The ancient Israelites enjoyed a unique relationship with their God. The reality and certainty of this particular relationship is an article of faith for each of the two literary religious traditions responsible for the Pentateuch as we have it today: the priestly and Deuteronomic traditions, or P&D as they are often termed. Although they differed on the precise nature of this relationship, the writers behind these two traditions knew that regardless of the scope of God's authority and sovereignty, Israel is foremost in God's mind. They described this relationship through the idea of covenant and invested it with such importance that one may say that the covenantal relationship to God is what defines biblical Israel. The Deuteronomic version of this relationship is familiar to most Jews. It's the relationship established when the Israelites declared all that the Lord has said we will do. It's the relationship outlined by Moses to the first post-Exodus generation of Israelites on the plains of Moab when he says, "Listen, Israel, today you have become a people of the Lord your God. Listen to the voice of the Lord your God and fulfill all of his commandments and statutes that I am commanding you this day." It's the relationship explicated in the second paragraph of the Shema, a relationship where obedience is rewarded with, quote, "rain in your land in its proper time, the early and late rain, and you will gather your grain and your wine and your fine oil. I will put grasses in your field for your livestock, and you shall eat and be satisfied," unquote. But in this covenant as well, as that same paragraph declares, disobedience and idolatry are requited with drought, famine, and exile. The Deuteronomic covenant mandates Israel's absolute obedience and loyalty to God. What is needed for this to happen is for Israel always to remember and never forget what God has done for the people and what God requires of them. Memory, continual and constant, is the guarantor of Israel's privileged position as God's beloved people. Forgetfulness is tantamount to apostasy. The priestly covenant, in all its variations, pre-exilic, holiness, and late exilic, is different. This covenant is a promise made by God and sustained by God. God promises the patriarchs land and offspring. God promises to dwell among the Israelites. God declares this relationship will continue forever, ad olam. Whereas for Deuteronomy, the onus is on Israel to keep the covenant intact and valid, for P, the responsibility is God's. The priestly tradition's overriding concern, therefore, is that God remain mindful of the covenant, that God remember his people. Only in the holiness version of the priestly covenant do we see demands made of the Israelites and penalties exacted for transgressions. But even here, transgression does not abrogate the covenant. If the Israelites, quote, "confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their ancestors," God says, unquote, then God promises, "then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and even more my covenant with Isaac, and still more my covenant with Abraham I will remember, and the land I will remember." That's Leviticus 26, verses 40 and 42. These two conceptualizations of the covenant are widely accepted by most scholars, as is the crucial role of memory for the Deuteronomic model. However, with respect to the priestly covenant, the role of memory, God's memory, is not well understood. Despite an explicit statement to the contrary in Exodus 2:24, when, after 400 years have passed, God remembers his covenant with patriarchs, God's memory is presumed to be perfect. This presumption is shared not only by the pious, but also by the foremost biblical critics of the last half century. God's remembrance of the covenant, writes Moshe Greenberg, is a feature of his trustworthiness. Umberto Casuto, Nahum Sarna, Reverend Childs, and without naming names, even some of the JTS Bible faculty, insist that God does not forget, and that when the text speaks of God's remembering, something other than recall is meant. But the God of the priestly literature, as I'll demonstrate, is self-aware with respect to the conditionality of his memory, and recognizes that it sometimes needs some assistance. If I am correct, and I believe I am, we have versions of Israel's covenant from each of the two primary Pentateuchal traditions, both of which assign memory a vital place. What I'd like to talk about first is, where does the covenant memory nexus fit within the theologies of D and P? And second, how does it play out for each? To address the first matter, I will turn to Genesis, the familiar stories of creation, the Garden of Eden, and the flood. In the accounts of these primeval events, the Deuteronomic and priestly authors justify the covenant as they understand it, suggest its purpose, and reveal how memory is and will be implicated within it. The priestly version of the creation. Genesis 1:1, through the first half of verse 4 in Genesis 2 is widely attributed to P, specifically the latest or one of the latest priestly strata in the Pentateuch. In this version, creation takes place over 6 days as God establishes clear divisions of dark and light, of night and day, of the heavens, water, and land, as well as clear delineations of what animal belongs in each realm. The world that God makes is organized and orderly. It is also essentially self-perpetuating. Its plant life, the trees and grasses, are seed-bearing with the seeds in them. Humans are charged to be fruitful and multiply, and given stewardship of the earth and its living things. God evaluates creation by sight, and as he regards each stage, God pronounces it good. As well, God seems assured regarding the world's stability and continuation, and so God retires confidently to his own separate kadosh space to rest, Shavat. As it turns out, however, humans are not the proper stewards God hoped they would be. They corrupt the world and fill it with violence, and God decides he must destroy all life save Noah and his family and, forestalling their extinction, pairs of every animal. God floods the earth and destroys it in retrograde order, the living things he had made in Genesis 1, and then God begins anew. The waters recede, dry land appears, Noah and his family leave the ark. The post-flood world is not precisely the same environment as that described in Genesis 1. For one, it has a few new rules, permission to eat meat, a prohibition on consuming and shedding blood. But its status as re-creation is suggested by God's first words to Noah after the flood. Echoing the charge given to the first humans, God tells Noah to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Moreover, the recreated world really will endure, for God promises Noah, "Never again will I bring a flood to destroy the earth." He enshrines his promise as a covenant and secures it through the mnemonic sign of the bow in the sky, which, when God sees it, will cause him to remember his covenantal promise. God set out to make a perfectly ordered and stable world that required little on his part to keep going, but realized he could not remain uninvolved. His active attention was needed if the world populated by fault-ridden humanity was to endure. Indeed, implicit in God's reliance on a reminder not to flood the earth is the suggestion that without it, when human beings again corrupt the world, God would bring about a cleansing deluge. But as I said earlier, God recognizes that he needs something concrete and visible to recall him to the promise to restrain such destructive force. Quote, "My bow I place in a cloud, and it will be a sign of the covenant between me and the world. When I cause clouds to cover the earth, the bow will be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living things," God says. "I will see it and remember." This is Genesis 9, 13 to 16. Now, two things must be noted about the priestly representation of God's promise. First, the promise is entirely one-sided. God is the one who will remember. God is the one who will ensure that the covenant is maintained. Second, what will cause God to remember is a visual cue, the bow, which God calls a sign. Genesis 1 already demonstrated that God is a visual perceiver. The role of the bow points to an association of God with memory and memory with sensual stimuli. This defines the priestly conceptualization of memory. The language employed by priestly writers to speak of memory, principally nominal and mainly associated with God, reflects that conceptualization. The nouns zikaron, reminder, and mishmeret, safeguarded thing, which are employed mainly by pre-exilic P, zikaron with a slightly different nuance by the Holy List writers, and the late memory term ot, sign, like the bow, refer to concrete mnemonics apprehended sensually. They designate visual or aural devices intended to induce recall, and they show memory, as P understands it, to be an act of retrieval prompted by a sensory cue. There are only two verbs in the memory lexicon of P, zachar, remember, and pakad, take note, and these are associated almost exclusively with God. It is God who remembers 6 times, plus a 7th implicitly when Israel is remembered, and God who takes note 4 times. Israel remembers only once in priestly literature, and when it does, the memory is false and impious. The people erroneously recall the fish and cucumbers and melons that they ate freely in Egypt, and rebelliously compare it to the manna provided them by God. Now, some may point out that the flood story also contains some other material, non-priestly material, attributed to J or the Yahweh sourced. These inclusions, however, are hardly gratuitous, for they permit the priestly writer to anticipate paradigmatically the religious program advanced by the priesthood. In this J source, God brings the flood because God regrets having created human beings. They are, quote, only evil all the time, rach ra, kol hayom. They are no different after the flood, but in the flood's aftermath, once God inhales the savory smell of Noah's sacrifice, God becomes reconciled to human nature. God says to himself, no more will I curse the earth because of mankind, for the inclination of mankind is evil from youth, and no more will I smite all living things that I have made. Smell, along with sight, affects the divine consciousness. Together, the priestly and Yahwist accounts of the flood demonstrate that God needs aids to prompt his memory and that smell disposes him favorably. He is a deity who is not merely receptive to, but depends on sensory cues to keep him true to his covenants and attentive to his creation. Herein, the flood story provides a paradigm for the priestly covenant and memory's role within it. God's covenant sustains the world. God must remember his covenant. God needs visual cues to ensure he remembers. God needs sacrifices to remain favorably minded. What, besides the intermittent bow, will remind God of his covenantal commitments? The priestly answer, and once again, I mean, whoops, sorry, I just lost something. Okay, the priestly answer is Abraham's, I know what I was gonna say. The priestly answer, by this I mean actually the late priestly author. Answer is Abraham, Israel's circumcised ancestor, who along with all of his male offspring bears the sign of the covenant. Secondarily, or subsequently rather, the provider of the sign will be Israel through the cult and rituals carried out by its priests and especially the high priest. As I will show shortly, the objects and rituals of the tabernacle provide God with visual, aural, and olfactory stimuli needed to awaken God's memory of his covenant and direct it toward his people. The Deuteronomic version of creation. Like the narrative of Genesis 1, Genesis 2 suggests a template for what God sought to create. And like the ideal creation of Genesis 1, that of Genesis 2 is short-lived. Beginning with Genesis 2, 4b, remember 4a was the end of the other one, this story describes a circumscribed area in which God provides directly for the needs of humans who in turn serve him by tending his garden. Only one thing is required. Humans must obey. Now, the Garden of Eden story is not a Deuteronomic work. It's generally attributed to the Yahweh source, and it owes many elements to ancient Near Eastern traditions, including the idea of a garden itself, the manner in which Adam is formed, the reason he is formed, and the tree of life. The biblical authors adapted these tropes to reconcile them with their monotheistic or at least henotheistic theology and culture. But in its final form, it shows signs of Deuteronomic influence. A number of features of the Garden of Eden story are, well, Deuteronomic. Just as the land of Canaan is, quote, a land that the Lord your God looks over, the eyes of the Lord are on it always, unquote, the garden enjoys God's exclusive and concentrated attention. The rest of the world, indicated by the four rivers which flow out of it, is of no import except as a place of exile. The abundance of water as an indication of the land's fertility matches Deuteronomy's employment of rain as a measure of God's favor and the covenant's operative status. As well, life in the garden, like life in the land of Canaan, is pretty uncomplicated. It requires one thing only, do what God says. But there is more than obedience, mere obedience at stake. The story underscores the value of intelligent obedience. This is where the introduction, unique in the ancient Near Eastern creation myths, of the tree of knowledge comes in. The inclusion of the tree of knowledge has to be intentional. Could it be attributed to Deuteronomic influence? Perhaps in an earlier version, the biblical story was much more like its ancient Near Eastern cousins than it now appears. I imagine an earlier version in which there was only a tree of life, and the story was principally an explanation for our mortality. Remember that when Adam and Eve are exiled, it is to prevent them from eating from the tree of life, and the tree remains guarded even after they leave. So I wonder, and imagine, Deuteronomic hands adding the tree of knowledge and doing so to represent an understanding of Israel's covenant that accords with Deuteronomy's. By introducing the tree of knowledge, the hands amending Genesis 2 and 3 introduced the idea of different kinds of knowledge, different intelligences. Adam and Eve did not lack cognitive powers prior to eating from the tree. We know this. Adam was charged with naming the animals. Eve debates the wily serpent. The knowledge of good and evil associated with the tree, therefore, is code for something else. What it stands for may be suggested by a verse at the very beginning of Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 1:39, Moses spells out what separates the Exodus generation from the people who are actually permitted to live in the land. Quote, "Your little children of whom you said, they will be carried off, and your children who this day do not know good and evil, they will go into the land, and to them I will give it, and they will inherit it." The knowledge of good and evil, Moses implies, is rebellious knowledge. It's hubris, apostasy, and it is inimical to life in God's land. Having eaten from that tree, Adam and Eve are exiled, and the primeval story essentially ends. There is no return to the garden, no recreative event restoring the original ideal environment. For this recreation to happen, God needs a new partner. Once again, the partner is first Israel's ancestor Abraham, and subsequently the Israelites on the plains of Moab. Abraham, that is to say, Abraham of Genesis 22, is the archetype for covenantal Israel. This Abraham is a nonpareil of loyalty, complying absolutely with God's command that he sacrifice Isaac. But what makes his obedience meaningful is that it comes from a place of reason and intelligence. Abraham's obedience in Genesis 22, rather than being incongruous when placed against his powerful challenge to God in Genesis 18 on the matter of Sodom and Gomorrah, can only be appreciated in light of Genesis 18. Similarly, it is the right kind of knowledge, information that is transmitted and repeated and remembered, that renders Israel capable of intentional fidelity to God's covenant. If covenantal Israel is to live in the land overseen by God, to return to Eden, the people must harness their intelligence to the observance of God's laws. As was in the case with the priestly writing, a particular vocabulary expresses Deuteronomy's conception of memory as an intellectual and verbal activity. Deuteronomy makes frequent use of a half a dozen verbs to describe the acts of absorbing, sustaining, and transmitting memory. Zachar, remember, shakach, forget, shinen, recite, lamad, learn, limed, teach, sima lev, take to, or literally place on the heart. All of these are verbs of cognition. Most have a verbal aspect. And in fact, the cognate to Hebrew zachar, the Akkadian cognate to Hebrew zachar, zakaru, actually means to speak. So there may even be a connection there. Taken together, these verbs show that memory, as Deuteronomy understands it, is verbal, durative, and content-filled. It is also intensely human. The verbs associated with memory are associated with not with God as in P, but with Israel. The Israelites remember, or rather should remember, as an ongoing activity by reciting, repeating, and teaching that which is to be remembered. So the opening chapters of Genesis, they offer two models for the world desired by God and two models for humanity's place within it. Both, however, are perverted by the presence of those very humans, and both must be terminated. But in neither case does God give up. The God of priestly literature invests in the world, promises to sustain it, requiring only that he be kept mindful of that promise. Keeping God mindful, according to the priestly writers, is the purpose of Israel's tabernacle worship, and according to the holiness offshoot, the purposes of Israel's observances. Deuteronomy's God is somewhat more parochial in his concern, or perhaps we might say more relationship-oriented. Having been disappointed by Adam and Eve, God finds another couple, a substitute in the Israelites, the children who do not know good and evil, who will enter the land and live in obedience to God's commandments. These are the people exhorted again and again by Moses to remember, to not forget, to be careful lest you forget what was commanded at Horeb, Deuteronomy's name for Sinai. These are the people told, quote, to teach these words to your children. Speak of them when you are at home and on your way, when you lie down and when you rise. a continuous exercise in the maintenance and transmission of faithful memory. With Israel now the chosen partner for God's covenant, how is memory involved in Israel's religious life? I'm going to give some examples from my book. I'll begin with Deuteronomy because its employment of memory is far more obvious, and since Rabbinic Judaism is really heir to Deuteronomy insofar as it relies on verbalized and text-centered observances, the place of memory and the practices mandated by Deuteronomy are more familiar. Above and beyond the domestic requirement to repeat the Torah to one's children day and night, previously mentioned, Deuteronomy introduces a few scripted catechisms and communal rituals whose purpose is the exercise of memory. One of these is the answer one gives one's child when asked about the law in Deuteronomy 6, 20 to 25. Quote, when your child asks you, what is the meaning of this decree and these statutes and the laws which the Lord your God has commanded you? You shall say, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord took us out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Other examples are the requirement that every 7 years during the festival of Sukkot, the entire Torah be read to all the Israelites, man, woman, and child, so that the entire people will, quote, learn to fear God and be careful to observe all the words of this Torah, that's Deuteronomy 31:12, and performance of the song that Moses teaches the Israelites in Deuteronomy 32. The memory-centered ritual par excellence prescribed in Deuteronomy is the recitation accompanying the dedication of the first fruits, the Bikurim, during the Festival of Weeks, or Shavuot, that's recounted in Deuteronomy 26. I'm sure you are familiar with this liturgy. We say it not on Sukkot, but on Passover. The recitation opens with the worshiper presenting the first fruits to the priest, saying, I declare today to the Lord your God that I have come into the land the Lord promised our ancestors to give us. That's Deuteronomy 26:3. It's a statement that makes him or her attest to God's fidelity to God's promise, as God had stated earlier in Deuteronomy. And further, it allows the worshiper to identify with the first generation that entered the land. Then, as the priest waves the presentation before the altar, the worshiper continues, an Aramean who wandered was my father, and he went down to Egypt and dwelled there for a short time. He became there a great nation, strong and mighty. But the Egyptians dealt badly with us, and they afflicted us, and they imposed hard labor on us. We cried out to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voices. He saw our affliction, our burdensome labor, and our oppression. The Lord took us from Egypt with a strong hand and with an outstretched arm, and with great sights and with signs and with wonders. He brought us to this place, and he gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now, behold, I am bringing the first fruits of the land which the Lord gave to me. The heart of the recitation is an abridged version of the national history, but it's constructed to internalize it in the mouth and mind of the speaker. Listen to how the pronouns shift. The speaker at first refers to my father, using the third person masculine singular. He went down. He became great. Next, he becomes part of the collective people. The Egyptians dealt badly with us, afflicted us, imposed hard labor upon us. We cried out, our fathers, our voices, our affliction, and our burdensome labor and our oppression. The Lord took us, brought us, gave us. Finally, as the recitation closes, he moves to the first person singular. Now behold, I am bringing, and the process of internalization is complete. This ritual involves the verbalization of memory. Like the domestic pedagogy, like the song and the seven-year reading of the Torah, it requires one to fix both the history and the obligation rising from it in the mouth and therefore in the mind. For Deuteronomy, the Israelites must speak constantly of their obligations to God so that they will not forget them and they will remain true to God's commandments. Turning now to the priestly tradition, we must distinguish between the three layers, the pre-exilic priestly tradition, the holiness tradition, and the priestly writings of a later, possibly late, post-exilic period. As I said earlier, the memory terminology and how it's used by each reflect their slightly different understandings of God's memory that distinguish one layer from another. But that being said, all three are alike insofar as they rely on concrete, sensually apprehended cues to stimulate recall, and all of them implicate God's memory in the maintenance of the covenant. The religious program described in pre-exilic priestly writings is replete with cues that seem to act literally on God's senses. Some anthropomorphism may have been modulated. The bread of the presence, for instance, may be a reflex of a more ancient concern for feeding God that has been translated into an element of the priest's diet. I see Leviticus 24:9 for that. But nevertheless, this tradition seems to believe that God's ears, eyes, and nose literally respond to the stimuli provided by the rites associated with the temple, or the tabernacle, as the Pentateuchal tradition represents it. God literally smells the pleasing fragrance of sacrifice, literally hears the sound of the trumpets, literally sees the reminders placed in his sanctuary, the half shekel, the Midianite booty, and most importantly, the high priest in his holy vestments. The half shekel, the Midianite booty, and the discrete parts of the high priest's garb are identified as a zikaron, a reminder for God. There is, just to be fair, one zikaron for the people's memory, the plating made from the fire pans associated with Korach's rebellion, and one reminder or safeguard, the mishmeret, whose mnemonic purpose may be directed to Israel's mind, although this could be debated. But the significance of these two items, the plating and Aaron's rod, is complicated and actually evolves within priestly writing. I'm happy to speak about both during the question period, but for now, rather than digress, I refer you to Adrian Levine's excellent book, Memory and Tradition in the Book of Numbers, and to chapter 6 of my book for their function with respect to Israel's memory. Returning to reminders for God, it should be noted that all of them are located or enacted in the context of the tabernacle and are therefore intended to attract God's attention. This is most evident in the case of the vestments of the high priest, described in Exodus 28. These are the ephod, the breastplate, the robe, and the diadem attached to his headdress. And this is what I'm going to talk about for a few minutes, so try to visualize as I'm going through this. The ephod and the breastplate are made of rich material, gold, purple-blue, purple, and crimson cloth. They are fancy. They're ornamented with gold ornamentation and embellished with precious stones. Two carnelian stones adorn the ephod, and on each is engraved, respectfully, the names of six of the tribes of Israel. These stones are called stones of remembrance, avnei zikaron, and are worn by Aaron so that, quote, he shall carry the names before the Lord on his two shoulders as a remembrance, unquote. For its part, the breastplate is decorated with 12 different precious stones arranged in four columns of three stones apiece. Engraved on each of them is a seal of a tribal family. Again, their purpose is so that, quote, Aaron will carry the names of the Israelites on the breastplate of judgment on his heart when he comes into the sanctuary as a remembrance before the Lord eternally. Turning to the robe. The robe is also made of blue purple cloth, but it's also ornamented by alternating gold bells and cloth applique pomegranates of blue, purple-blue, purple, and crimson around its hem. The purpose of the bells, the text explains, is as follows. Quote, whenever Aaron is obligated to officiate, their sound will be heard when he comes into the sanctuary before the Lord and when he leaves so that he will not die. Exodus 28:35. In other words, the bells forewarn God of Aaron's entry and departure from the sanctuary. And by this I mean, if you can just bear with me for a second, the inner sanctuary is the part of the tabernacle that you have outside, you have the courtyard, and then you have this half of the space is the inner sanctuary, and within that is the Holy of Holies, which is where the ark is. We're talking about the space outside the Holy of Holies, but not in the courtyard, okay? So, in other words, the bells forewarn God of Aaron's entry and departure from the sanctuary and may dispose him more favorably towards the rites that Aaron performs. Yet the allusion to death is telling. It reminds us of the danger associated with the kedusha, the holiness of God. Think of the consequences of Nadab and Abihu's improper incense offering, or the destructive power of God on the Exodus night, or for that matter, the flood. The high priest's responsibility for the rites that will keep God mindful is both fraught and critical. He is the one who gets God's attention, and he is the one who ensures that the attention is for good. The final part of the high priest's vestments is the turban, and its central feature is the gold diadem, or tzitz, that's set upon or suspended from a cord of twisted purple-blue linen, petil techelet, and placed on the headdress. With the words, consecrated or holy kadosh to the Lord engraved on the diadem, the tzitz points to the exceptional position of the high priest. In effect, the diadem consolidates the overall function of the high priest as the one who represents Israel before God and as the particular agent through whom God remembers Israel. Now, the term zikaron in connection with the ephod and the breastplate identify those portions of the high priest's vestment as explicit reminders for God. The inscriptions on the stones and the diadem tell us what God is to be reminded of, his relationship with Israel, and the role of the high priest himself. The bells on the robe may also serve to bring the high priest to God's mind or to protect him once he has God's mindful attention. Taken together, the vestments underscore the necessity of the high priest and the rites he performs to keep God mentally tethered to his people, to ensure that the eminent deity dwell among them. The high priest also recalls God to his covenant with Israel through his multicolored, flashy vestments, which as an ensemble resemble the bow God established to remind him of the earlier covenant with Noah. Indeed, the association of the high priest's vestments with the iridescence of the rainbow was suggested by Ben Sira, chapter 50, which describes the high priest as being, quote, like the sun shining in the temple of the king, like a rainbow, keshet, seen in the clouds. And in Mishnah Yoma, where the proceedings for the Day of Atonement are described, and in a number of medieval piyutim, or poems, composed for the Avodah service of the Day of Atonement, these references are provided. Here's an example cited by Cecil Roth in a 1971 article in the Journal of Biblical Literature on Ashkenazic rites. In truth, how glorious was the high priest as he came forth from the Holy of Holies in perfect peace. As the brightness of the vaulted canopy of heaven was the countenance of the priest, as lightning flashing from the splendor of the chayot, as the celestial blue in the thread of the fringes, as the iridescence of the rainbow in the storm clouds, as the glory wherewithin the rock has clothed his pious servant, as a rose planted in the midst of the pleasant garden, as a diadem set on the brow of the king, as the mirror of love in the face of a bridegroom, as the halo of purity shining forth from the mitre of holiness. The high priest, these latter sources recognized, served as an analog of the bow, that is to say, the reminder to God of his promise to the world. And like the bow, the high priest is the single figure who has the power to appease God, to stave off God's wrath. Think of Pinchas's role at Baal Peor, when his thrusting through the bodies of the impious Midianite woman and Israelite man staves off a plague. Or when Aaron, in the aftermath of the Korach rebellion, brings the incense offering into the middle of the camp and again stops a plague. Those are number 25 and numbers 18, respectively. So for the priests of the first temple, that is to say the pre-exilic period, the rituals of the temple and the high priest performed the essential job of keeping God's attention on Israel. What then was to be done when the temple was destroyed and the Israelites lived in exile? How would God remain cognizant of his covenant with temple rites and with no temple rites or high priest? A solution came from the authors behind the holiness tradition, who translated the priestly temple-centered program into practices that could exist in exile, outside the temple context. As Israel Kanol has shown, one of the holiest innovations was to invest Shabbat and circumcision with heightened religious significance. These two practices had the virtue of requiring neither a temple nor a priest to be performed, and so were suited to the condition of exile. Moreover, as they helped to define the exilic community in opposition to their Babylonian neighbors, they also defined the recipients of the covenant. Another adaptation was the investiture of lay Israel with a level of sanctity formerly attributed only to the high priest. All Israel in the holiness conceptualization is a kingdom of priests, and all Israel is capable of being holy to God. On a concrete level, this new understanding of all Israel is manifest in the holiness tradition's introduction of the fringes as a reminder for the Israelite people. The law of the fringes occurs in Numbers 15. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, make fringes, tzitzit, on the four corners of their garments for all generations, and attach the tzitzit to the corner with a cord of twisted blue linen, petil tchelet. They shall be your fringes, and you shall look at them and remember all my commandments and do them, and not wander after your heart or after your eyes and lust after them." the assonance relating the fringes, tzitzit, to the diadem worn by the high priest, tzitz, along with their fabrication, both attached by twisted blue linen, petil techelet, cannot, I hope, have escaped your attention. Recall that the diadem, or tzitz, reminded God of the unique status of the one designated holy, kadosh, to the Lord. The holiness writers transformed this reminder for God into a reminder for Israel to behave in a manner that would make them holy to God, so that you will remember and do my commandments and be holy to your God. I, the Lord, am your God. Now, directing the attention to the Israelites, being a reminder for the Israelites, this call, the function of the fringes may seem like we're talking about a Deuteronomic kind of memory tool. But in fact, it is quite different. The mnemonic quality of the fringes is tactile, sensual, and not verbal or instructional. And its objective is holiness. It's that special set-off status according to Israel by means of God's covenant. Notice that there are no actual laws included when we say that paragraph of the Shema. We just have the laws in general that we're supposed to be reminded of. Now I'm going to turn to Shabbat and circumcision, and to the latter strata of priestly writing, which transformed each of these two practices into the ultimate divine mnemonic, the Oat, or the sign. The term Oat, sign, is used in a variety of ways. There are the signs performed before the Israelites and Pharaoh in the Exodus story. Deuteronomy refers frequently to the signs and wonders of the past, which Israel is enjoined to remember. And of course, there is the sign of the bow. In the hands of the late exilic priestly writers, circumcision and Shabbat assume the status of a sign, and as such, like the bow, become central reminders for God of his covenant. As the text makes explicit, both circumcision and Shabbat are signs of the covenant. Circumcision signaling the covenant with Abraham, Shabbat the sign of the covenant with Israel. But is either associated with memory? If so, how? Certainly, circumcision and Shabbat differ from the Zikaron-type reminders of pre-exilic literature. What gives them mnemonic power? Since the answer is more obvious with respect to circumcision, let me start there. When circumcision is introduced in Genesis 17, the text provides no information as to the sense or mechanics of circumcision as a sign, the connection between the act and its meaning. Its salient feature must be explained elsewhere. One place is Zechariah 9:11, which refers to the blood of the covenant, but two others come in Exodus, specifically in connection with God's selection of Israel and God's capacity for destruction. These emphatically demonstrate an apotropaic utility of blood. First, in Exodus 4, 24 to 26, when God, the first is in Exodus 24, 26, 4, 24, 26, when God tries to kill Moses. This strange event is sandwiched between God's instruction to Moses to threaten Pharaoh, saying, "Say to Pharaoh, Israel is my firstborn. I said to you, let my firstborn go so that he may worship me. And if you refuse to do so, I will kill your firstborn," unquote. Between that and the actual onset of the contest between Moses and Pharaoh. In between these two events, Moses stops at an inn, and the text tells us, God sought to kill him. He is saved only when his wife Zipporah circumcises his son and wipes the bloody foreskin on Moses' leg. The blood stops God short and aborts the danger. The second demonstration of blood's protective power is the blood on the houses of the Israelites on the Exodus night. This protects them from the murderous force of the destroyer. God says in Exodus 12, verse 13, "The blood will be for you a sign on your houses in which you stay. I will see the blood and rescue you, and you will not be afflicted by the destroyer when I smite the land of Egypt." Blood, it seems, stays God. Like the bow, it puts a brake on the destructive capacity of God. In a positive sense, remember, though, the bow also assured the endurance of the recreated world. As a sign, Shabbat replicates this function. Shabbat, as I said, is identified as a sign in Exodus 31, verses 16 to 17. You'll know this verse. "The Israelites shall keep Shabbat and observe Shabbat for all time, an eternal covenant. It is a sign between me and the Israelites forever. For in 6 days, God made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day, he ceased," Shabbat, "and was refreshed." The text, alludes explicitly to the priestly creation story, retroactively investing God's rest then as an anticipation of Israel's Shabbat. Israel's observance of Shabbat concretizes, therefore, the sacred time and aligns the temporal cycles of Israel's life with that of God. More than mere imitation of God's creation and rest, Shabbat provides a scaffolding on which the temporal calendar hangs. By observing Shabbat, and indeed all the rites of the year, Israel enacts its status as the one people participating in the divine time in God's recreated world. Through the observance of the Shabbat and circumcision, we, the Israelites, and then we ourselves, effectively carry out the role of high priest, keeping God mindful and attuned. Because both are signs, that role is elevated to that of the bow, which secures all of creation, and Israel becomes priests for the world, a kingdom of priests. Now, I've drawn rather firm lines between Deuteronomy and the priestly tradition with respect to their takes on and use of memory. And as I close, I'd like to soften those lines a little bit by pointing to a contemporary practice that incorporates both and that perhaps gives us the opportunity to enact the sign-like function that the Israelites do through circumcision and Shabbat. I'm going to refer to the Seder, the Passover Seder. The Passover Seder, as we all probably know, gives us ample opportunities to actively remember our history. That's what we do. We tell the story. But it is not mere narrative. Were it only narrative, I doubt its popularity would be as what it is. No, the Seder also asks us to provide signs for God. The careful choreography, the abundant reference to symbols, the ritual, all of these don't just engage our memory. Might they also be signs for God? Thank you. Yeah, I'm happy to take questions if anyone has any. Yeah.
So what happens when God removes himself from the Israelite people? How does that happen?
You mean during in the exilic period, you mean, with exile? It's a really good question. I mean, I think that, you know, you might call it a sleight of hand. I think the holiest tradition decided to, or I don't know if decided is the right word. It's always hard to know how deliberate these things are. Came to understand that God could not be limited to one place anymore, that God had to have a more transcendent nature, which meant that even if they were exiled, and that God could be aware of them in an exilic environment. I think what really happens is in the pre-exilic period, my sense is that the people behind that the priestly tradition really believed that God lived in Israel, lived actually not even just in Israel, lived in the tabernacle, and so the idea was to keep God there, because if God could be there, then God could also be elsewhere if He wasn't there, and you don't want that to happen. But once, as other notions of God in a more transcendent way, some of this comes from Deuteronomy's understanding of God, that it was useful to adapt that. You know, I mean, your choices were either say the covenant's over and we're lost, or figure out a way to make it still work, and they figured out a way to make it still work. Yeah.
I think I heard you say that refer to the fringes as a tactile sound. But in the paragraph, it only speaks of the visible side of the fringes, of the color, and that you will see them and remember. So I don't know why you choose
the tactile in particular.
Yeah.
Because that they are also a visual sign. Yes. So I should point that out. They are both visual and tactile. Thank you for pointing that out. The reason I mention the tactile is because that's really the unusual thing that distinguishes them even more from the sort of major forms of perception. We tend to think of sight as our primary form of perception, then sound maybe in equal competition, but touch seems to be, it's like of a lower order. So the fact that it's being brought into me is significant.
No, I'm just worrying that you might be conflating the how we use the fringes.
Oh, okay. Good point. Thank you. That's a very, very good point. Yes, thank you. It's a good point. I'm take note of that. Do you have a question?
I'm just sort of pleased to be here and say I'm distracted by what I'm doing here. And the price of the having another generation of Yehuda Ketuvah alive and severely celebrated for 25 years, and I'm looking at Book and Law and thinking my family, the Danilos and Jerubeka, mm-hmm. fine family, the giant, mm-hmm. flesh ripped off at Dachau mm-hmm. at the very beginning.
Important, thank you. Yeah. Anybody else besides? Yeah. It was an acknowledgement of the wall memorial over here. Oh, before that, what is your name, sir?
David.
David very very appropriately reminded me that I was possibly anachronistically treating the tzitzit from numbers in the way that we use them, which is to touch them, to hold them, and that in fact the text doesn't mention that they're being touched at all, and that they're if they have a sensual element, it's visual, seeing them and seeing the blue thread within them. So I also want to thank him for that. Anybody else have other questions? Yeah.
It seems to me that the focus of remembrance has shifted to the point of in a way blaming the victim. It is now anything that happens to the Israelites or to the Jewish people because they fail to remember or they fail to perform whatever it is that they are to perform rather than God being there, mindful, remembering, looking at the signs and taking care of business.
You're really so right, and that's, I have had some discussions with people about this. When I started doing this work on this project, I didn't know that I was going to decide that priestly religion is really way cooler than Deuteronomy. it's also much kinder, ultimately. Deuteronomy is pretty rigid and says that, you know, basically it's up to us to do it, and if we blow it, you know, there's a little bit of a concession to, okay, we might be able to ask for, you know, to repent, ask for forgiveness and get another try. But it's not particularly forgiving, really, in general. Whereas the priestly tradition, by putting the onus on God and doing so in the face of knowing that we're basically flaw-ridden, in both the Yahwist and priestly versions of the flood, that's a given. And so by taking that responsibility, God in a sense says, I know you're going to screw up a lot and it's okay. I'll come up with ways to take care of you. We unfortunately, as a people, and this is particularly true in the West, are heirs of Deuteronomy. And that's one of my advisors when I was doing my dissertation put it this way. Ever since Luther, we're all Protestants. All of us, you know, so that, you know, the idea of the sort of the magic of God, the notion of God's having this kind of otherness of being, you know, having a kind of power that might be potentially dangerous as well as potentially positive, of being really personally present and relevant, those things are so hard for us as modern people to accept. And I think we've lost something in a way of that. I mean, I think that we've lost some of the romance of religion in that way. And one thing I hope that this work shows is, actually, and this is one point I didn't get to say, but I'd like to say, the Pentateuch doesn't pick between them. You know, they're both there. And even though you might argue that, okay, the priestly version comes first, so maybe that's giving it precedence, they're both there. And maybe that's something that we can take it to heart, is that, you know, you need both of these kinds of ways of interacting with God. You can't totally let us off the hook and have God be totally responsible. You're not going to have a successful human civilization that way. But at the same time, it's nice to know that, you know, if we mess up, God's going to be still with us. You can't only rely on talking and verbalizing and telling stories, because eventually it gets boring. Think about all the problems you have at synagogue when it gets really dull. Sometimes you need some fireworks, you know? And so sometimes the fireworks are what are going to keep you feeling like there's something really special happening. So I think that there's some beauty in the fact that both of these are there. Yes?
In most cases, God's forgetting is not good. Israel's forgetting is not good. Are there positive examples of forgetting?
There are. Yes, there are. They're not in the Pentateuchal material. But yes, it's a very interesting thing. There's a wonderful article by, I'm now going to forget who it is, but I can look it up in the about God's forgetting. And this is an article where it's mainly based on the psalm material. In the psalm material, where God's forgetting is seen as a boon, as a gift. God will not remember our sins. God will not remember our transgressions. But this article is rather interesting because the person who's writing it is, I believe, a Catholic, and he's trying to explain the notion of God's forgetfulness to an audience of people who assume that God has perfect memory and that that is only a good thing. So he's trying to show that actually there is a, it's a merciful forgetting that God has. And that's where that comes in. Anyone else?
Last question.
Is there any last question or then? Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yes, back in. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go to my, I could have done that. You know what? Go to the chapter on the holiness tradition. Take care of the others there, okay? Yeah, it's a complicated one, but it is, and it's an important one, but I had to pick what I was going to deal with, so anyway.
Okay, yep. Thank you. Sometimes we need either fireworks or a good barbecue. I just want to thank Bara for reminding me all of the wonderful reasons why this is such a great book. And if you all go out, those of you who don't yet have copies, if you go out and order it within the next half hour, we can raise your number on Amazon.
Wow!
at least for a short period of time,
right.
The hundreds or something.
Right, I can
like
be
that.
Like one
so
millionth and seven.
You know, do it when she goes home tonight. She'll be really excited. We've got a very rich sequence of programs. So let me just repeat it to you very, very quickly. Next Monday, Ed Feld, who many of you know, will be here to discuss other biblical material, Joy, Despair, and Hope, on reading the Psalms. Next Thursday, we have a special program that the library is sponsoring, The Ongoing Threat of Right-Wing Extremism in European Democracies. This is a discussion with the heads of a foundation in Germany that is dedicated to fighting right-wing extremism. So it'll be a very interesting discussion. Tuesday, March 18th, we are the holders of the Johanna Spector Archives. She was a very distinguished anthropologist, ethnomusicologist, and she did some very wonderful work on a variety of Jewish communities around the world. We will be having special programs devoted to several on March 18th. That will be on Yemen and its Jewish community. Rabbi Gadi Kapel, whose family comes from that community, will be here to speak as well. And finally, in April, Thursday, April 10th, Dr. Mel Skolt will be here to discuss his most recent book on the Mordechai Kaplan Diaries. We close the evening, I just want to say one more thing. I want to thank this gentleman here for noticing this piece on the wall over here. I think it's fair to say that most people at this institution do not know that the Jewish Theological Seminary has a Holocaust memorial. I've known it was there, but actually focused on it only for the first time, sitting in a seat somewhere here at a recent book talk. Most people walk by it if they ever come into this space at all. You will note that it is a miniature version of the very distinguished Last March by Nathan Rappaport. This very same image appears on the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial in Warsaw, which was erected just a couple of years after the end of the war, and an identical version of it is also found at Yad Vashem. We are now searching our archives here in order to try to discover exactly how this version got to be here. So maybe at some time in the near future we'll be able to report on that. In any case, thank you for coming, and we hope to see you at future book talks.
Thank you.
I just want to say, when I went to university, I came across this table of books, and one of the Casuto.
What we don't like to remember.
Okay, we just keep right over. Pause.